How did you first come up with the idea of joining the Air Force or the military?
I think the recruiters came to my high school and asked us to take the aptitude test.
Everybody.
I don't think everybody, but like they come to the school and they offer, and they kind of make like a deal out of it, like, you know, there's going to be pizza and candy and all that, whatever. And so I ended up going to do that. I don't remember exactly, because at that time I was definitely smoking a lot of pot and my memory's a little hazy.
When did you start smoking pot?
When I was 15 or 16.
And who introduced you to it?
My brother was the first person, like, to introduce me into doing it, like, on a daily basis. Actually, the person that introduced me to it was a Canadian who was living in America. Just a friend of a friend.
And what about your middle name? Whose idea was that?
I think... Maybe my dad, or both my parents, possibly. I'm not sure.
What culture is it from?
It's actually Hawaiian. So I was born on Maui, and we were there because my dad was a commander for the Star Wars project, which was where they were shooting lasers at satellites and then reflecting them back down to targets on the ground, on the Earth.
Under Reagan.
Yeah.
Right.
And Bush.
Right.
I think Bush put an end to it.
And what was your father's reaction to you joining the Air Force?
He actually passed away when I was 16.
Oh.
So he was drinking so much. By the time I was 12, that's when my parents divorced, and I moved out to Ohio with my mom and my stepdad around that time, and my dad stayed in Montana.
Wait, so your stepdad is this your mother's third?
Yeah, third.
Husband. Right. It's an unusual reversal. It's usually the other way. It's usually the man who has a series of wives. So, and when you're talking about your father beating up your brother and vice versa, that would have been when you were quite young then.
Yeah, like, my first memories, maybe of them fighting, would be around 5 years old. I was five, yeah.
And how soon do your memories begin before that?
The first memories I have are when I was three. I remember being car sick. And then I remember a going away party when we left New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. And your father left the Air Force when you were one, did you say?
Yes, so we left Maui and went back to the Air Force Base in New Mexico, and that's where he retired. And it wasn't, he was forced to retire because there was a drawdown at that time with Bush, and he didn't make the cut for his next promotion. So then basically the way they do that is if you don't promote in a certain time span, then you don't get to stay in. But he was at that point, he had been in for like 19 years or something. So
I'm presuming he was drinking beforehand, but it spiked after he lost his military position.
I would say so, though I don't know how much he drank while he was in. I'm sure that he drank a lot while he was in, but he at least had some kind of, you know, purpose or something, you know. After he got out, he did have a few stints as a math professor at some universities when we, like, in Montana and but as far as like a persistent full-time job, he never kind of got back into that. He had some idea of being a Mr. Mom type, you know, and like doing like fixing up the house and all these different things, but he just kept getting more and more dysfunctional.
Did he talk to you about his time in the military besides that Marines story?
A little bit. He liked to talk because he was a navigator, so he used to fly. So there's a pilot and a navigator in a jet. So he was in like the second seat. It's like Goose if you saw Top Gun. He liked to tell stories of flying. He used to tell some stories of his time in Vietnam as a radio operator, in the Marines. I mean, he was still essentially like an infantryman. He did two tours there, and he said he felt like Superman during the first tour. And then somewhere in the second tour, he realized that war was maybe not so great, or at least shooting people for a living was not so great. But that he was approached by a private contractor on his flight home, which he said he thought was... He wasn't sure if it was a private contractor or another government agency. And I guess he didn't feel that war was bad enough to not join the Air Force. So, I guess he just didn't maybe like that, you know, being able to see the target. I guess if you're flying at 60,000 feet, then it's not so bad.
Right. And do you
I was gonna say, I guess to kind of tie in with maybe interesting bits of it, he had been to Area 51 a few times, and he did have a story of seeing an aircraft that maneuvered in a way that no aircraft he knew of was capable of doing. But he didn't say that he like ever saw aliens or anything like that. He just said that there was an aircraft that was maneuvering in a way that he didn't know was capable, or that any aircraft that he had, you know, been around was capable of doing.
So what was he doing in Area 51?
I don't recall a specific story about that. He used to like just telling that he went there, and maybe he didn't tell the story because like when you have a top secret clearance, you're technically not supposed to talk about stuff like that, like so I don't know if that was part of it. I think maybe he was just doing war games there, because they do a lot of that in Nevada. But he never told me any specific story about Area 51, just that he had been there.
And when did he tell you that first time?
I don't recall for sure. I mean, young, maybe, you know, somewhere between 5 and 8.
So he was telling you about Area 51 because people were talking about it and the X-Files and stuff.
Probably, yeah. And, like, you know, we'd have, like, you know, house parties or something like that. And so it was kind of like an interesting story. And I'd be present when he'd be talking about some of that, you know.
Did he have a lot of military friends?
Not in Montana, which was, this would be that time. It was, yeah, just him.
And do you have any anomalous memories from childhood that you would say kind of unusual?
Not really. I did have like a really weird anxiety attack once, where like I was like in the bathroom, and I was maybe, you know, around 5 years old, six, something like that, and I was in the bathroom, and like all of a sudden I felt like really small, or like the room got like really large, and I felt like overwhelmed, and it was, yeah, I guess the best description would be kind of like an anxiety attack, about like I just couldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But that was pretty much it.
What happened?
I think it just passed eventually. I remember telling my mom about it and being pretty concerned, and that I want, and I do remember that she took me to like a therapist or a psychologist or something, and when he asked me about it, I remember that I lied, and I like had some story like that there were ghosts in the house or something, like there were ghosts telling me to start the house on fire, but I consciously knew that I was lying, but I didn't really know how to describe the feeling that I had.
So you made up a story that there were ghosts telling you to burn the house down.
Yeah.
That's an odd story to make up to, you know, avoid getting into trouble or what have you.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about that. but yeah, I guess I remember that. It was definitely like a peak emotional memory in my childhood, like high anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And I only have like a memory of it happening once, but I kind of have an idea that maybe I had a couple other anxieties, but I don't really have a solid memory of that. But yeah, I don't know.
Is your mother still alive?
Yes, yeah.
You could ask her. And what about dreams and stuff? Do you have any very vivid dreams from childhood?
From childhood, the most vivid dream I have is like being in the house, and there being like dinosaurs outside. This was like kind of like when Jurassic Park had came out. And, I think it was just like them to go away or something like that. But my dad was there at the door. And like, as soon as like things would start to like quiet down outside, then he would like throw something out the door. And then all of a sudden there'd be like stampeding, like and the house would start shaking again. And like, I remember like he was smiling.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So your dad was encouraging the dinosaurs, the monsters. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, Whitley would have a field day with that one.
Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, I've not followed Whitley, but except for your work. But,
yeah. Well, probably enough to get the joke.
Yeah, yeah.
So then your first experience of non-human interaction was on LSD, or what seemed to be non-human or discarnate or what have you.
Yes. Definitely like a faceless figure. A feeling of like terror and death, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I Yeah, it was, so I would, again, it was at like a, I think is like a Indian locate, like a ceremonial location, in Colorado called Red Rocks, which is like a place where they do like concerts and festivals now. But I think it has some kind of native history. I'm not sure on that though. But so I was at a concert. And, I had, this was like a, I mean, all my abuse up to that point was pretty arrogant and reckless, but this was like particularly arrogant use. And cause it was like some, a batch that I hadn't tested before, you know, and so I took like four and, it was, it put me into like way more intense of an experience than I was ready for. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend there with me because I at least tried to have, I guess, some kind of person to watch out, you know, I guess we try to watch out for each other to in case someone freaks out. But so I had him take me to like the back of the concert, and because like the feeling I was getting was like I was starting to like feel other people's like emotions and like sexual energy. And like, so like a lot of times if you go to like a concert, you can kind of like see in people's eyes, or I could, like this sexual desire, and like these people would be on like cocaine or ecstasy or LSD. And I just start just to get like this pervasive experience of, I guess, strange to me, sexual desire. And, so I had to like get out of that throng of all those people. So I got out into the back and then things were going okay. It's kind of calming down, you know, and then we went to the bathroom. And I started looking at this guy that was, you know, going, taking a piss. And I had the experience of, like, connecting to his mind, sort of. Like I was kind of, like, reading his mind. Like understanding his thoughts. And then he turned around and looked at me as if, like, he could tell. And then that just like threw me off into like a really weird space, and I started freaking out. And that's when I decided like I had to like get out of there. And so, you know, I was like telling my buddy, hey, we gotta go. And then I started having all these like really paranoid thoughts of, you know, like the government is, I don't know why I started thinking about like the government, but like I definitely was thinking about government agents. And then I saw this thing walking alongside me, and like it wasn't like that it like didn't have a face, it was like you just couldn't see it was like really weird like obscuring of vision. I don't know exactly how to describe it. It wasn't just like a dark no face. It was like you just couldn't see. Hmm. And but it was like at the same time it was like taking the form of different friends in my life, like really close friends, and describing to me that you know, it was like this was the night that I was gonna die. And and then I remember like the terror that I was getting into, like pretty much all I could think about was like trying to get home to my mom, which was like, you know, impossible because she was like, you know, over 1,000 miles away. But yeah, all I could think of was going home to my mom, and that like somehow if I kept turning left that I would get there. Huh. And and this was like really like looking back on it, like I don't know why my friend let me drive at that point, because I was definitely like talking to something that he couldn't see, and you know, so I was pretty mad at him at that. Like he was supposed to like keep me from driving, I think. Like, but yeah. So anyways, I started driving, and I kept turning left, and eventually I turned left onto the highway going the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, that's, I realized I was on the wrong side of the highway, and so I was like, I got off on the shoulder, and but I, like, this thing was in the car in the passenger seat with me, and I just couldn't, you know, at that point I was, you know, not able to follow like a coherent path of anything other than like I thought I was about to die. And then of course then the police got there, and yeah, then they tased me 4 times, and then I went to the, then they eventually took me to the hospital to because I wouldn't talk to them. At least I did that. Like, I was smart enough to not, or I was coherent enough to know not to talk to them at all.
So, but why did they taser you, do you think?
Well, because I wouldn't get out of the car initially. Actually, I did say one thing to them. I said, I know my rights, which is, is like such a stupid thing to say maybe, but like, and I guess maybe like, I know my natural rights or something, like you shouldn't be able to commit violence on me or something, but yeah. I wouldn't get out of the car, so that was the first time they tased me, was like I needed to, like they needed to get me out of the car. So they tased me and got me out of the car, and then I would just keep standing up and not let them manipulate my body physically, and so it took another 3 taser shots before I couldn't resist anymore.
Hmm. Wow.
And I still have like a little bit of memory of like the electricity, like, and then so like I've had a couple of experiences since of like sleeping, like being asleep, and then being kind of awake, but being like feeling paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
And then like having a very strong sense that something was just outside of my vision, like I couldn't move and like something was there.
Mm-hmm.
And like, and then there would be kind of like a light and sort of like a memory of electricity, and that's happened twice since then. And like, and then like one time it happened, and like once I was able to move, then I saw like something, but like just like leaving, like I guess, like, you know, maybe a discarnate entity leaving but like catching it just out of the corner of my eye or something. It
was, leaving the room.
Yeah, leaving the room. Well, no, it was like outside my window, and the bright light at that time was like, I don't think it was a full moon, but it was a pretty bright moon, and like I just remember seeing like a shadow kind of like darting away, and I was able to move. And then the other time was I was in a car, sleeping in a car, and the bright light was a street lamp, I think. But like I had the sense, like the immediate thought I had when I like was like approaching consciousness, was that like something had like electrocuted me, and like I had woken up, and I felt really paranoid. And yeah, and it, like unable to move, but then once I was able to move, then nothing was there except the lamplight.
These anomalous experiences started after your LSD period. So yes. During and after that.
Yeah.
Did you grow up in the same house, or were you moving houses, or which?
Yeah, I moved a lot. So I was born on Maui. Then from 1 to 3 years old, we lived near Albuquerque, New Mexico. And then from 3 until 10, we lived in a small town of 80 people in Montana. And then from 11 to 14, a town of about 10,000 near the Canadian border in Montana. And then from 14 to 19, I lived near Cleveland, Ohio. And then
and your mother was away a lot during your childhood.
Yeah, until I was about 13.
Do you have any memories of being in any of those bedrooms and trying to find your mother or wanting your mother to be there?
No, I don't think so. No. Nothing comes to mind.
Can you remember your bedroom from that second house when you were up to age 3, was it?
No, the only memories I have there were just getting car sick once and then my going away party.
Right. But then the third house when you were 3 to 10, can you picture your bedroom there?
I can picture it, and I do know that I used to wet the bed there for longer than normal, like basically until I was like 8, I think.
And can you picture your mother's bedroom?
I can picture it, yeah.
Can you picture yourself going from your bedroom to her bedroom? Or can you
Maybe.
remember what route you would have taken anyway?
Yeah, I can remember that.
Yeah. So what is it? What do you have to do?
So my room was on the lowest floor of three, and I would have to go up one set of stairs onto the main floor, and then up another set of stairs up to their my parents' bedroom
Yeah.
to the left. Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering if you were gonna turn left at any point was the main reason for
Oh
that. But yeah.
yeah.
Also just for an evocation really of that time. And going back to the this faceless entity that appeared after you had this kind of visceral sense of other people's sexuality, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You does this it reminded me of how in our email exchange you talked about how sex, how you view sex as a kind of soul trap. So, is it was that impression? Is there a connection, do you think, between that? That sense you have, and I know there are other experiences that have led you to believe that, but that this particular experience of the of that visceral
Yeah.
sense of, yeah.
So during that period, I used to, I guess I viewed sex as like, I didn't pursue it. And, it seemed kind of dirty to me. And just like there are plenty of, people in their lower 20s around me all the time, having sex, and it's just, like a lot of promiscuity, and it kind of just sort of disgusted me, and but that didn't stop me from spending a lot of time with these two strippers, who I didn't go to strip club. I did go once, but that was because they wanted me to come. But I just happened to know these two strippers, and I'd go to the concerts with them, do drugs and stuff. And I guess I didn't s see them as disgusting as people, but I definitely thought that like the whole business of stripping was kind of disgusting. I still kind of feel that way, like it's like whenever I see someone, like sexual desire is like kind of uncomfortable for me. And like if I see someone looking at me in that way, like actually really like in the last few months I've gotten a lot better about like eye contact, but like during the last like 2 years especially, like I like eye contact was really weird for me. Or actually I think always eye contact's been weird for me. And like a lot of times my thoughts would lead like eye contact would mean like eventually at some point in any kind of relationship, whether it's just like casual or, like friendship, like the idea would lead towards sex somehow. And it was like uncomfortable to me.
Right. Like equating it with sexual intimacy. And then, because the faceless being, there was no danger of eye contact
Right.
there. I had a kind of somewhat similar experience, I think, to what you're describing with the people and their sexuality. Once when I was on Salvia Divinorum, and I had had a really profound, had gone into a very profound, profoundly different state of consciousness, and I was at home, and then I went into town just to see if I could, you know, deal with social interaction while I was in that state, and I ended up in a dance bar in Guatemala that I used to go to. And once I was in the bar, I had the experience that everyone I looked at, I was going to have sex with.
Yeah. That it's, yeah, kind of similar. Like, I've never had the feeling like I would have to, but it seemed like it would lead to it.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah, and I interpreted it at the time as something to do with having no psychic boundaries, and so that just looking at them meant that I was somehow merged with them at this profoundest possible level, and therefore, and then that I was rationally or irrationally interpreting that as literalizing into a sexual act. Well, that's how I interpreted it at the time. But what I'm wondering about now is, you know, where would that experience of having no boundaries come from? And, well, I'll just say what I was thinking, because it's about me, it's not about you, that if as a child I wasn't allowed to have sexual boundaries, and maybe even I literally had an experience of, well, I mean, I don't want to overinterpret, but I just to consider the possibilities anyway of the kind of more mundane way of understanding something like this. Obviously it's not really mundane, but in a sense it is. As a child, like if I was sexually interfered with as a child by adults, I don't know that this happened, but I definitely leave a space for it, and there does seem to be evidence for it. That this experience later on could be evidence of that, as in, you know, I had an experience of a child of anyone I looked at which was going to have sex with me, kind of thing, or that happened several times, that just getting the attention of some adult led to them, you know, interfering mm-hmm. with me in some way, and how that would have interfered with, I mean, obviously my sexuality, but also my ability to develop boundaries. And of course to feel safe around adults. And I do, you know, as you read in Prisoner Infinity, that there does seem to be a correlation between having these psychic boundaries violated as children, and being psychically open as adults, and having these kind of very strange anomalous experiences that take on more archetypal qualities to them. So for example, this faceless entity, I mean, again, it's risky to interpret stuff, but I'll take the risk.
Sure.
Here that like there may be something there that you the somebody's face it wasn't safe to remember as a child.
Mm-hmm.
As you were saying, it wasn't that they didn't have a face, but you couldn't focus on it. So that could be a kind of memory. There could be a body memory of somebody that told you you were going to die, not literally, but something about them made you feel that you were going to die, whose face you weren't able to remember, that it wasn't safe to remember. And then that comes, you know, that your psyche summons that memory in a way that is outside of yourself as an encounter.
I mean, it's hard to say what the interpretation, where to take the interpretation, but what you said makes sense in a way.
It's yeah. a, I mean, the, my aim would not be to give you an interpretation to then apply, but to open up an avenue of reinterpreting or of interpreting for yourself and of looking at the different pieces. It's really tricky, but then you and I are talking, so you kind of know how I'm going to see and interpret these experiences to some extent, as in I'm not going to just go away and say, oh, that guy was part of MK Ultra, look, all the evidence is there, because right. it's not up to me to reach that conclusion. It's not going to help anyone to do so. It would just be dishonest. I don't know, obviously, but and this is kind of, I mean, usually I don't do the podcast, don't usually go this route in terms of the person sharing so much personal information and me just listening. But in this case, it has. And one of the advantages of that, I think, is that it's not random. It's like if you wake up in the morning and you've been dreaming all night and you can only remember a few fragments spread out across the night, you feel as though that's just a random thing. But if you actually recount the fragments, when I do anyway, often they're really interconnected, and you can see how they're all pointing at a similar kind of narrative, how they are related, the parts that we choose to remember. And of course, why wouldn't they be, right? It's not random what we remember, so nor is it random what you choose to talk about with me in a two-hour conversation, right? It may seem random in the sense that there's thousands of experiences that you could share, and you end up settling on just these ones because of my questions. And I'm not, you know, my questions are kind of random too, as in I'm just thinking on my feet. But of course, it's all in the context of, you know, what drew you to my work, which is the effects of child abuse and of trauma, which is, you know, what you're involved in now in terms of understanding that more. You've presented a bunch of pieces that they don't have to be interpreted, but they can be laid side by side, or they are being, and then looked at together as opposed to separately. So I mean, I won't be able to remember all of them, but obviously, your father being in the military, so being born, you know, while he was working at an Air Force base, moving at one, then these anxiety experiences you had very young, the peeing in your bed, your mother's absence, the dream of your father letting in the monsters, your experiences with sexuality, which you haven't really gone into, but you just touched on, your difficulty with intimacy and your own sexuality, and then this faceless entity and the death anxiety around that, and then the need to find your mother that was associated with that, how that led to this encounter with police where they tasered you. I mean, real abuse of power there, being physically abused by a bunch of men. The electricity, I'm not sure how to interpret that, but it seems significant to you, because in terms of a body memory, of course, that does tie in with MK Ultra, actually the electricity, but I just thought of that now. And then, of course, the fact that MK Ultra was a trigger for you. It was literally a trigger, as in it stuck in your mind enough that you turned it into a password without knowing what it meant. So it had some resonance.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows why? I mean, that really is, that's obviously a big question mark. One doesn't want to interpret that, except that just something in you was drawn to that narrative for whatever reason. And then there's all those things which are, you know, that they're significant individually, but they become collectively a lot more significant in terms of your formation. And I mean, one of the things that stood out talking to you was very early on was when you said that about being an enigma to people, mm-hmm. and how you wanted to become less of an enigma and be able to be more honest and truthful, represent who you are more accurately to people. I mean, that stood out for me because I think essentially, I mean, that's what this podcast is for, is for have to have a space where I can be truthful and others can be truthful, and that's what life is about, really, is being full of truth and yeah, as full as we can be, being filled up with it and being able to just become true. So obviously that would stand out for me. And that's the context, really, for me listening to you has been, I mean, I'd say, like, at a visceral level, I found it more difficult talking to you than I usually feel. And it could be, you know, I just had lunch. It could be my digestion. So don't assume that this has anything to do with you. It might not. But there is something about your way of talking which is quite ponderous. In fact, I was going to ask you about what you've experienced yourself as in terms of feeling and mood. You know, I'll just ask you. Yeah, I mean, what would you say is the predominant mood to your existence?
To my existence currently?
Yeah, let's keep it current.
I guess maybe a little anxious, just because, like, laying out the story is a little bit, like being a little vulnerable. And though I don't feel worried about it, but I mean, obviously it's quite a few personal details, and I haven't really laid out the story as much as I have now. In one place, before, all these details I put forward, I think I've laid out some of them to some people here and there, but never all together like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely, like, I wanted to do it because, in a sense, it helps being free of hiding it. Yeah, I think. But I'm also, at the same time, I'm a little anxious about it.
So that's how you feel about talking with me.
Well, I'm not sure, because I don't think I felt anxious about talking to you, but my thoughts say, like, anxious, which should be how I should feel, I think. But mm-hmm. I don't think I feel anxious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you don't sound anxious, but then, of course, anxiety doesn't necessarily come out in... doesn't necessarily come to the surface.
Another thing is, you mentioned digestion. I'm actually fasting right now.
Yeah.
I'm participating in Ramadan. I'm not Muslim, but kind of doing it out of solidarity.
Uh-huh.
So I think in fasting, which I've been doing it since May 26th, so I just eat one meal
after dark,
yeah. And I think that doing that keeps, like, your emotional level pretty stable, maybe. I don't know, like blood sugar stays pretty stable, and I don't feel too emotional during the day.
Mm-hmm. I mean, would you say that you're a happy generally during in your life, or would you say something else? That was what I meant by the sort of a prevailing mood, not just of this conversation, but just generally in your life.
Recently, I feel happy and excited, but I've definitely dealt with a lot of depression through my life, and a very like flatness in my outlook emotionally. I think I have used your work as, or maybe I've like, yeah, I guess as like a template maybe, in or like a litmus test for like trying to find something. And almost, you know, I don't know if it'll work, but and maybe it's like trying to save time, because I know you're like twice my age. Mm-hmm. And like reading like the, I guess the progression of your work, like I read Matrix Warrior and then Seen and Not Seen, and then your blog work, and I definitely have used that story as a way to help myself judge what I want and how I can fit into a community, or I guess what I want from a community. And I don't know if it's going to work for me now where I'm at, but it seems exciting and it seems like a good place where I can fit in. And I did have one confrontation with the main elder there, and it was actually part of my fasting. He was explaining to me about white men and cultural appropriation and that being a concern, and I guess maybe like my participating in Ramadan is like a, I don't know, like irresponsible somehow. But I really think that the conflict was more, or the confrontation was more of me being enigmatic, and like a snake in the grass, maybe, and that he wanted to challenge me and make sure that I wasn't a threat, and it did resolve, and he makes a very strong point in direct communication, and I'm so with being direct and truthful and confronting things like childhood trauma and having practices of trying to find healing and work towards integrating difficult life experiences to work towards wholeness. I definitely feel like the community is a place for that. And I only work part-time, but I end up doing service work with the community the rest of the time. So there's not a lot of money involved, which feels pretty good. A lot of it is either like trading for like my place to live, like the rent, and like the community garden for food, which feels pretty good to me. As far as like not being so involved with money as a way of progressing in a social environment. But I don't know if saving time will help. Like you said, maybe it's just part of going through life experience that, like you said, you weren't 50. You were 50 when it finally started to integrate for you, maybe culturally.
Well, I think there's something to be said for having positive influences and examples, for sure. And I don't think I had any, many. And if it turns out that I'm able to be that for others, well, then that justifies what I'm doing in a big way. I mean, there would be no way to justify what I'm doing if that isn't true to some degree. You know? Although Oscar Wilde says there's no such thing as a good influence, so I don't know. not to be quoting Oscar Wilde, but anyway, I'd be very surprised if it was only through discovering what I'm doing. But you've realised that childhood trauma is very central to what it is that you want to explore and understand and address. So then, the more that you're able to put your attention on that in a positive way, then the more you'll understand why you need to be addressing that.
Yeah, I'm, like I said, I'm excited for this time coming up, but I'm also there's definitely like a navigation process in like just moving into this house, like not stepping on toes is definitely going to be a challenge for me, like in that I'm supposed to bring some sort of structure to the house, and but at the same time I have a preoccupation with liminality.
Right.
And so maybe it's like a way of balancing those two, and also maybe healing the parts of my life where I had the structure, like kind of integrating that in a way that is not violent, but also like in interacting with these young people coming from abusive backgrounds, being present in their how they experience me, like in like being present in interpreting my behavior around them, maybe I can also find healing for myself.
I mean, that's what I was trying to say rather clumsily, was that if this, I mean, if you're drawn to this work, then it's be something in yourself that's drawing you to it, and that this may well be the most efficient way for you to become conscious of what that is and heal it. Just like, you know, like the work I'm doing is about that, finally, for me personally, and that it does seem that that's the only way to be effective or helpful to others, is to find what we need and give it to ourselves in such a way that others are benefiting from it. Yeah, which doesn't have to be a public thing. I mean, I guess it does to some degree. It has to be part of the community, whether it's the alternate perceptions community or whether it's the, you know, the local, the town that we live in, or both.
It's kind of interesting because if I take my perception of you from kind of like an, like I guess like a narrative point of view, and maybe tying in your whole Matrix Warrior thing, is like you've almost been kind of like a Morpheus in a way, but then like on a shadow side you've also been a bit of like a Merovingian.
For you, and, you mean?
Yes, for me, yeah. And like Morpheus in the way of kind of like my searching through a lot of this traumatic static and finding something, like finding a signal in that, and that going through your work, it's inviting, but it's also challenging. But then on the other side of it, like as the Merovingian, like you're pretty eloquent, and you know, maybe I could be like, you know, wiping your ass with silk, and then there's the ancestors aspect to the work, I think, like confronting that, and then kind of having some of these keys, like holding on to some of the keys to these doors into our interpreting trauma or finding architects. I think that it has been helpful, but also dangerous, and maybe unavoidable for me to follow what you've been doing.
Right, follow in the, I mean, the two senses of follow, right?
Yeah.
Follow as in just keep up with, and follow as in try and imitate, which would be the dangerous route, for sure.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I'm no one to imitate, that's for sure.
Well, yeah. Well, and then I guess, yeah. I'm also like wary of the will to power, which it seems like a lot of your work tries to shed light on just how pervasive the will to power is in what we do.
Yeah.
And kind of like the unconscious side of us that is like wants to be like that Agent Smith mind virus, where we like that shadow side of wanting to make other people see things from our perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just being aware of those unconscious sides of ourselves really helps.